I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. You've heard the good news that American incomes, high, middle, and low, have turned up, perhaps decisively, in the ninth year post-meltdown. Do you believe it or feel it? Does it relieve your sense of a chancy, maybe rickety economic system under this collapsing political campaign for the future? Here's a sample of what people said to us on Boston Common this week.
You're talking to a guy who's unemployed right now, so I don't think this economy is where it should be.
The vocal ones think we're going into the tubes, tanking, but the reality is I think things are improving.
I don't know, it seems like they rave about the economy, but nobody's feeling it around here. A lot of people I know are kind of right now going like paycheck to paycheck. Then I know other people that were really struggling had to move back in with their parents.
Well, I feel fortunate myself. I just recently retired, and that's going fine. I understand that there's a lot of people that feel they can't retire, and that's obviously a terrible situation. I mean, probably more people than not feel they have to just keep working until they die.
You can never feel secure in your job. They just laid off a bunch of people where I work that are 60 and over, that have been there for 35 years or more. It can happen any day. They're not going to let you work till retirement age. That's scary.
We grew up knowing that things were going to be not so great, and that's what everybody told us all throughout college, was that it was hard and that millennials can't do this, millennials aren't buying houses. So in terms of what we've been expecting, it seems better than what people have been saying, but I know it's not the case for everybody.
There are two elephants in the room this hour. The live one is the political economist Mark Blyth of Brown University, the noisiest guy, we always say, in any Glasgow pub, a real butcher's son from Dundee who keeps telling it straight about money and power. The other elephant is a ghost, an echo getting louder from the late John Maynard Keynes. He was not an economist so much as a moral philosopher of the good life who wrote endlessly about employment, interest, and money. Keynes theorized the 35-year boom after World War II to the point that the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon White Houses and Time Magazine, even Milton Friedman, got to singing in chorus, "We are all Keynesians now." Then he went way out of fashion in the Thatcher-Reagan free market revival and the global expansion of the last 35 years. But the Keynesian pulse is reviving in late 2016. And so we are listening for just what it means. Mark Blyth, introduce the course, the general theory.
All of it.
Chapter by chapter.
Right. Okay, everyone, pay attention.
Scripture.
This is what we're going to do. All right. So let me tell you two things about the general theory. So the first one is, the first chapter is a paragraph. And in the paragraph, he says, everything else that you thought was economics is actually a special theory. What I'm about to show you is the general theory.
Special and general invokes, of course, Einstein.
Exactly. So this is not someone who thinks he's writing a footnote. This is the big story. So what's the big story? There's lots of ways of telling the story, but here's how I like to tell the story. You probably heard the line, in the long run, you're dead. We're all dead.
And you're going to explain the depths of that remark.
So the full quote is about how economists set themselves too easy a task, predicting in the long run, blah, 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 because we live in the short run. So there's a politics to it. But the important insight is this. Why is it? He's writing he finishes the book in 1936. So he's writing it through the 30s, through the Great Depression. Why is it that depressions happen, and why are they so hard to get out of? And there's a clue in the word. We're kind of depressed. Or rather, our expectations about the future are depressed. Now, if you're an investor and things have been great for 2 years and they have a bit of a bump, you don't really think it's bad. But then things stay bad for 2 years. And you look at all the other investors and you think, well, I'm not going to invest because he's not investing and she's not investing. And if everyone cues off of everyone else's short-term expectations, guess what happens? You're halfway to creating a long run, which is exactly where you don't want to be. The long run is nothing but the sum of our short-term expectations. So the Keynesian trick was, how do we change through external forces the investment expectations of the investor class? And that's why spending was important. And that's why intervention is important, because it's about changing the psychology of investment. It's not about just chucking money around for the sake of it. That's the crude and, in my opinion, very wrong version.
In the long run, we're all dead. A depressing prospect to begin with. But he's saying, act now. Treat the patient meet him where he's at.
Exactly. And ultimately, you know, he was, as you say, a capitalist revolutionary. And let's clarify what we mean by that. He had no intention of socializing everything and letting the government run the economy completely. What he wanted to do was create the conditions of investment whereby you would have permanently full employment. And what that meant was creating an economy of full employment based upon high-level consumption and high wage growth that would power forward and become self-sustaining. And coming off of the Great Depression, mass unemployment, what that produced in terms of politics, communism on the one hand, Stalinism, in fact, fascism on the other hand, anything which could stabilize capitalism, produce full employment, and produce wealth for the overall middle, that really was the Holy Grail. And he figured out a way to get there.
He really did. That's the amazing thing. For fun of it, I went back and read Time Magazine's cover story on John Maynard Keynes, December 31st, I think it was, 1965. Before Vietnam had ruined the Johnson era. It was heaven, Mark, in the thinking and in the rising boats. I mean, it was astonishing what he pulled off.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just him. I mean, you know, he died shortly after the war, and there were people who picked it up and so on. But the basic impulse was known around the world. The Swedes had their version of it. The Brits, obviously, he was one. The Americans had their version. And the basic idea was this. If the Great Depression and everything that happened was caused essentially by letting capital loose around the world to do whatever they want to do and to chase the last buck and to squeeze labor and to fetishize gold and so on and so forth, then what we need to do is isolate the domestic economy, make people invest at home, raise that level of investment, and that's how you get jobs going. As I was saying, he's a capitalist revolutionary. Why? He doesn't want to get rid of the investor class. He just wants them to invest. And he was pretty good. He wants them to invest. For him, the problem is when they get spooked and sit on the sidelines, that's what causes a depression. So you've got to have investment going forward to create jobs, to create the rest.
You're right. He was dead 20 years before it came to full blossom in this country. But it was a Hubert Humphrey dream. And at the core of it was the idea of full employment.
Yes.
Where in the world did that goal disappear to?
All right. So I'm going to tell you a little story about how this comes off the rails. At least I think it does. So let's think about the politics behind this. You could have the smartest economics in the world. You don't have to be Keynesian. It can be any, whatever flavor you like, whatever listeners are. My favorite is this. Okay, let's start with that. Here's your problem. Imagine a Keynesian politician. So everything's going great. It's going super great. In fact, the economy is really bubbling along to the point that, you know, you're getting wage increases for like showing up on time. All the labor markets are full. They have been for 25 years. Labor can move costlessly from job to job. What's happening to profits? They're going down. Because you're constantly bidding up wages to catch skilled
labor. Is that the record, really?
Well, you start to get a profit squeeze in the late 60s and into the 70s. Hmm. And then what happens, of course, is labor's organized. This is part of the deal. Business is organized, labor's organized, COLA contracts, all that sort of stuff. So you've got powerful unions, and you get a huge spike in strike activity in the 1960s and into the 70s. And the only way that business can adjust if their profits are going down is by pushing up prices. But if you push up prices, what does labor do? It comes back and says, push up wages. Guess what? It's called cost push inflation. We got that starting in the end of the 1960s.
And stagflation, they call it.
Not yet, but then when you get the oil crisis and the doubling and then the doubling again of input prices, when it was a much more industrial-based economy, suddenly you have inflation. And then what happens? Remember those investors' expectations? Keynes was still right. They got spooked. They started to sit on the sidelines. Investment starts to fall, so you have inflation at the same time as you have rising unemployment. Well, that doesn't sound like a Keynesian world. In fact, it was the Keynesian success that created the fragility that ultimately led very shortly after 65 for the whole thing to start coming off the rails.
So we speak familiarly now across the board of a bad 35 years, late 70s to this moment. What is the evidence, as you see it, Mark Blythe, that it's Keynes time again, that something is turning once more?
One of the things that Keynes figured out, and many economists before him figured out, was that if you leave markets to do what markets do, and you have property rights whereby the people who have, let's say, patents get all the returns, then essentially you'll create a winner-takes-all dynamic. All the money will flow to the top, and then right at the bottom, there'll be people with hardly anything. David Ricardo saw that clearly. My favourite Adam Smith quote is this one: for every rich man, there is 500 poor. And were it not for the firm arm of the civil magistrate, he would sleep every night insecure. right? So this is a long-run story, right? So if you have that world, and that's the world that we've created again, then what you have is that consumptive base for the economy is stretched. Now, before the financial crisis, we filled it in with credit. Now everyone's had more than enough credit. You can cut interest rates to zero. They're not borrowing. What they need is wage growth. How do you get wage growth? How do you do that? You have to basically push the bottom up and bring the top down. That's a Keynesian moment. Whether it demands a Keynesian economics or politics, that's a different thing.
What are the other big things that have changed since he wrote your general theory, including the extent of globalization today, climate change, immigration?
Well, everything constantly changes. And, you know, to say that it was somehow static then and has it changed now? Well, you know, from his point of view, he went to college in 1910 or thereabouts. By the time he's writing in the 1930s and 40s, it's a whole new world. We're constantly living a new world. Climate change is the absolute huge one, in my opinion, and we hardly ever take it seriously enough. But look at the transformations for millennials. The gig economy, the whole notion that you're on your own as some kind of independent contractor. What happened to notions of citizenship, solidarity, to go back to the point on full employment. Where did that go as a goal? Once we started to worry about inflation, we told everybody, you're on your own.
Plus, he would surely be wondering about this Brexit collision of globalization, sovereignty, popular local will.
Well, yes and no. I mean, one of his lines, which is a nice one that says it all, is above all, let finance be local. Because he really thought finance was dangerous if it was let out of the bottle. And you could argue Brexit is a consequence of that globalization, as you just said.
What would he have... He wouldn't have voted for Brexit, would he?
That's a very good question. I don't really know.
I didn't even know it was an interesting question, but we'll come back to it. We're talking about the economy and the return of Keynes, if that's what it is, with Mark Blythe of Brown University. Coming up with the roving reporter and lefty activist Sarah Jaffe. A quick tour, Seattle, Fort Wayne, New York City, of economic symptoms in America today. This is Open Source. The writer Sarah Jaffe makes house calls all over the country to measure not just economic distress, but popular pushback. She calls it necessary trouble, in a new book subtitled Americans in Revolt.
I was just in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was so interesting because I live in a deindustrialized town, right? I live in Newburgh, New York. Industry has been gone from there for 30, 40 years. When I think about like the 2008 financial crisis, and it obviously didn't start any of these processes, it just sort of turned them up to 11. Like the terrible, grotesque metaphor of the frog in the boiling water, right? It's slowly being turned up. One factory closes, another factory closes. And then all of a sudden, the bottom falls out of the economy. 6 million people lose their homes to foreclosure. And that's an undercount. 10% unemployment, also an undercount. It put a cap on this thing that had been happening forever and made people really able to visualize it.
Stick with sites.
I lived in New York City. I lived in a place where I was getting gentrified out as a person with a graduate degree and a decent job at the time, and I was getting pushed out. And if I'm getting pushed out, I make more than the median wage in the country. What is everybody else doing? And yet at the same time, you see skyscrapers going up and up and up and up and up. Half the apartments in them are empty. People are buying them as tax havens. People are pushed further and further out, and then Hurricane Sandy comes in and wipes out a bunch of what had been the only affordable housing in New York City.
The nation is a patient. Chief complaints, as they say, CC in the hospital. Primary symptoms that you've seen on the road that we don't see on page one.
Thanks to thousands of people going on strike against low wages, we do talk about the fact that some 40-something percent of this country makes under $15 an hour. This is a huge, huge issue that most of the jobs created after the financial crisis and the quote-unquote recovery have been lower-wage jobs than the ones that were lost before. People who had what we would have considered a middle-class job are now in a service industry job. Just like there was nothing about factory jobs that had to make them good jobs, there's nothing about service industry jobs that has to make them bad jobs, except for the workers in them don't have power. It all tracks with the decline of unions. If you pull up the graph of the decline of labor unions in this country and the rise of inequality, they go in opposite directions.
we talked about the housing crisis and like the way that the housing market continues to be manipulated for the same banks, the same private equity firms, the same hedge funds to make money off of housing. And now, you know, developers getting back into the act and building high-end housing in all of these cities.
Isn't it interesting that the housing bubble and the collapse and the economic collapse, the banking crisis, mm-hmm. foreclosures, and now we read the banks that foreclosed are renting some mm-hmm. of that same housing yeah. to the former mm-hmm. owners.
Yeah, or they're buying it up. You know, when I'm talking to friends who are looking to buy houses as people in their mid-30s do, used to do anyway, and they're saying, like, you literally have to, like, get approved right away and go in because otherwise people are just going to come in and buy it in cash. Who's buying with cash? Again, right, we call them the 1% for a reason. There aren't that many of them. And there is an article in the Times the other day about the top end of the real estate market is oversaturated, and now all of these landlords in these luxury buildings are having to give people like 4 free months of rent to get them to sign a $3,000 a month lease. Is it that hard to remember 8 years ago? I remember 8 years ago. Mm. It could happen again because we haven't changed any of the fundamentals of the economy. There's a hunger out there for something that will be that fundamental change, and this election just isn't going to be it.
But in the optimistic spirit,
yeah,
think of three fixable crises and how you do it.
Build public housing, create universal health care. Oh my God, universal health care. And forgive all the student debt.
You sound ready for a fight, Sarah, in a very dark, multiply dark scene. Is there a way to describe your outlook at this point?
I'm optimistic. I really am. I think it's amazing that 12 million people voted for a guy who calls himself a socialist. I did not think that was possible. When I first heard about Occupy Wall Street, I thought it was going to be nothing. It totally surprised me. These movements have over and over and over again surprised me with how successful they've been. I didn't expect 5 for 15 to spread across the country. I didn't expect a city to elect both a socialist city councilwoman and also actually vote for a $15 minimum wage less than a year after its first fast food strikes in Seattle, right? And so I remain optimistic even in the moment of Donald Trump, largely because I don't think that presidential elections are the epitome of politics.
What is?
The people in the street.
That was Sarah Jaffe of the Nation Institute in the new book, Necessary Trouble. We're talking about the money subtext in probably every presidential contest, pretty well buried this year under personal invective. Mark Blythe of Brown is our studio guest. Mike Konzel joins us, writer, blogger, with years of experience in finance and a reform zeal for politics. He's a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute in New York, hoping to shore up the legacy of Eleanor and Franklin. Mike, please, sort the economic signals you hear in the noise of the trash talk between Hillary and Donald.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. It's kind of interesting because there is a little bit of the ghost of John Maynard Keynes in this election. Neither of the candidates have been talking a lot about the debt or the deficit or a kind of austerity mode where they need to, you know, cut entitlements or cut spending or tighten our belts or the government's like a family and we need to watch our budget. That talk, which was so prevalent in 2008 and 2012 and in between those times, has just disappeared. It's definitely not in Trump's platform. And even Hillary Clinton isn't talking about it at all. Both candidates have put forth a big infrastructure spending investments to the tunes of hundreds of billion dollars. Crucially, and this is a very interesting development, is Donald Trump is, often he's very inconsistent with what he says. But one thing he's been a little consistent about is saying that, you know, he wants to have more debt. That is good. We want to build, you know, have infrastructure bonds so people can hold them. And it's a very business way of talking about
that. Yeah, it's not Mitt Romney either.
Yeah, no, Mitt Romney wanted to cut the deficit, but he also wanted to cut taxes. We're hearing a little bit more, I think. So I think just in terms of the straight up, you know, build infrastructure. Now, some of that infrastructure is reactionary, like a giant wall, right? Even though Mexico is going to pay for it. But it's still thinking in terms of big public projects, right?
Good job, and the good wages, as Mike Dukakis used to say. They don't talk austerity anymore because Mark Blythe wrote a book attacking it. Explain what that means. I mean, what a shift it is for people to be accepting a lot of the Keynesian premises, but also extending them in the sense of borrow for everything tax for nothing, which Keynes wouldn't approve. But what is the shift here?
So the two big things happened. One is, you know, we had a period of pretty ugly austerity. We had something called the sequestration back in 2013. Basically, we just cut a lot of government jobs. We cut spending, and it was bad. It didn't help the economy, didn't increase confidence. Investment is still very low. Interest rates are crucially very low as well. Inflation is below where we expect it to be, and the economy hasn't picked up. So there was a lot of posturing and a lot of movement that essentially caused us to go into this austerity moment, and it did not help. And crucially, you had a lot of crying wolf by these, like, you know, austerity focused people who really wanted to cut budgets and cut spending, saying we'd have a financial crisis in 2013, a financial crisis in 2015, where interest rates would soar. And, you know, you look right now, interest rates are actually down a third from where they were earlier this year. You know, they're below 2%. They're at all-time lows. So the kind of debt hysteria never panned out. And I think people are finally tired of listening to them. And they're thinking, okay, so given the fact that interest rates are going to be low for a long time, because we've entered this period of secular stagnation, as Keynes would say, you know, the animal spirits are just in the wrong place for having full employment and high investment. You know, maybe we should be investing in infrastructure. Maybe we should stop being so obsessed with the debt.
Mark, take credit for being anti-austerity before it was fashionable. But also speak of some of the things that Mike has mentioned and the low-hanging fruit still out there, like student debt, like minimum wage, like...
Well, let's start with the wage issue. So... We're all aware through the work of Thomas Piketty and others how the world has become very unequal. We know the stats for the United States. My favourite scary one being 70% of the income gains that went to the top 0.1% since 2000. So of all the income gains that were appropriated, 70% went to top 0.1%. So that's kind of spooky. Now, we've had positive wage growth. There's a big piece in the paper yesterday. Hey, it's up 5%. Well, with an underlying economy doing 2%, given the wage skew, right, how different it is across the wage distribution, you would need years and years of sustained wage growth. Now, it's hard to see where that's actually going to come from, even if you build a whole bunch of infrastructure. And goodness knows this country certainly needs it. So it's more than just building infrastructure. It's about actually changing the focus such that it's no longer a case of government's this kind of weird thing and we have to pay for it to protect us, but other than that, we hate it and get out of the way of markets. It needs to be a much more sort of synergistic or cooperative effort. And that's what was at the heart of the post-New Deal, Kennedy era type of corporatist, to use that language, political economy of that period. But you can't go back to the past. We live in a global world. You've got candidates of left and right promising to bring back manufacturing jobs. It's never going to happen. Capital substitutes for labor at the margin. When the cost of capital is zero, as it is now, labor's positive. Why would you do that? When you put tariffs up against Chinese firms that export to us, one of the biggest ones is Apple. What are you going to do? Put tariffs on Apple so the iPhone costs more? What does that do? So within the stuff that you could put a Keynesian tag on, there's also a whole bunch of nonsense being spoken.
Mike Consell, I'm digesting your thought that Donald Trump is a Keynesian. He's a spender. He's a borrower. He's a builder. Wouldn't his first fight, if he got elected, be with Paul Ryan and the oldsters in the Republican Congress?
Yeah, I mean, it might be useful to think of a lot of the practical right would be this kind of reactionary Keynesianism, right? Their big things right now is spending a lot on the military, and there is nothing that is more, make work than building things that are designed to explode shortly afterwards, right? There's big tax cuts for the rich, which would, obviously boost consumer spending. It'd all be on yachts and gated communities and private forms of provisioning for social goods. But, you know, it would still be spending in the economy. So there's this kind of dark reactionary Keynesianism that would be out there. They would not call it that, right? Let's be clear on that whatsoever. They're not wouldn't use those terms. But when they say in private deficits don't matter, when they imagine spending a ton of money on the military, project all kinds of strength and so on and so forth, I feel like there is a kind of thinking about the way the economy would ultimately work. And second is, as Mark brought up, there's a ton of low-hanging fruit and there's a lot of things that aren't being done on the wage issue, from stagnating minimum wage to low unionization rates to outrageous spending in healthcare and in financial services. And I think that spirit has been all through the primary. It's what gave Bernie Sanders 12 million voters and has led to all the waves of activism that your previous guest, Sarah Jaffe, documents excellently in her book. But it's also, in the dark side, animated Donald Trump. And a lot of people feel very left behind and very alienated in a globalized economy, in an information economy, in a service economy that doesn't provide stability and jobs for them. They're rebelling, and we are seeing the dark, you know, and they're blaming and scapegoating foreigners and immigrants and, you know, people of color and Muslims. And we're seeing the kind of dark implications of the fact that we have, as Mark said, spent decades in this free market fundamentalism that has just assumed away the idea that wages and economic stability are important social goods.
Mike Consul and Mark Blythe, look at three what I would call new normals in the daily discussion of the economy. One, the precariat that except at the top, workers are in danger. Second, the debt just goes on forever and ever. It'll never be paid, and we're putting it all on a credit card, somebody's credit card. But third, that the very anti-Keynes would be distressed that the boom and bust cycle is much worse today than it was at any point since the World War II. And that it was his big undertaking to break that cycle. And we've had more recessions, deep and global recessions, in the last, 20, 30 years than ever. Take them as you will, but these are...
All right, I'll take the last one, and Mike can pick up one of the other two. So booms and busts. Booms and busts are usually associated with financial cycles. And if you go from 1946 until 1976, there were zero financial banking crises in the United States. Because oddly enough, that correlates perfectly with the Keynesian era. Because one of Keynes' favorite lines was, above all, let finance be local. And after the New Deal, they put it in a box.
This is the Brexit mystery.
Not just Brexit, it was global. They put it in a box. They had what were called capital controls throughout the world. You could move money abroad if you were building a factory in France, but there were no derivative markets to go trading on. But once you let that out of the box, as we did in the Thatcher Reagan era and beyond, then you create a world in which capital flows around the world are 100 times trade flows. Well, what are they doing? Well, that is the speculation. That's the destabilization. Keynes was keenly aware of this. So those boom-bust cycles, he would be disappointed with that. But to go back to the politics for a second, he'd also be disappointed with the caliber of politicians. Because what's meant to happen is when you're having a boom, you're meant to save. When the boom goes boom, you're meant to raise taxes. You're meant to cool off the market. Now imagine the incentives for anyone in Congress standing up and saying, things are going great. Your house just went up 6% a year. So I'm bringing in a whole series of taxes to stop that one. Yeah, that'll happen. So the economics can be totally sound, but you'll find that the politics behind it fails.
So no new taxes, the watchword forever, maybe.
Well, simply there's no incentive to cool down a boom. And if you can't cool down a boom, you're going to get a bust.
Mike, who's going to rescue this precariat? Or is that forever too?
A couple quick points. One is the precariat. I mean, there are new realities about service work and about globalization and about tradable and not tradable goods. But as Sarah Jaffe pointed out, you know, jobs have always been precarious. It's just a question of what kind of social insurance we put around it. Do we give workers voice in their workplace? Do we give them protections in case jobs come and go? Do we make sure that education and healthcare and retirements are secure and independent of how people work? You know, the precariat is not just a reflection of the means production, the current state of technology, but it's also social institutions and just simply a social relationship between workers and owners that we always have to keep in mind. You know, we always want to reinvent the wheel, but these fights have gone on forever, and they went on with factories, they went on in farming, and now they're happening now in services and knowledge work. As what Keynes would make for now, you know, the Great Depression is so much worse than what we had now, right? That was a 50% drop. That was really prolonged. The Great Recession was about a 10% drop. I think what would really upset Keynes is that we know what to do now. In 1928 and 1931, they weren't really sure what to do, or they thought really bad things about what to do. We know exactly what to do here. We know exactly what to do in Europe, but people are refusing to do it. And I think on one hand, we have some safety, like the Fed did not let the banks fail. We're not on a gold standard. We have automatic stabilizers, and we extended unemployment insurance, and we did all this stuff, but we didn't do it enough. And then once it got a little rocky and there was some political pressure, we stopped doing it at all. And I think that would frustrate the heck out of Keynes. and he would have written some really brilliant stuff, terrorizing and parodying the idiots who are put us in this position.
Mike, you're one of those policy dudes, I won't say wonks, but the Democrats will rely on if they get back in the White House. I mean, do you know what to do about full employment?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Fed needs to not screw it up. The Fed is itching very hard to raise interest rates. It thinks it's going to normalize. It thinks, crucially, it thinks everything's going to be okay, that we just had this one bump in the road, happens every 70 years, and now we're out of it and everything's okay. I think the smart people are thinking, I think it's correct, that we're in a new normal of very low interest rates, where it is very difficult or tough to get private industry to invest, to get people employed to where we need to be, where states have reactionary governors and certain kinds of legal infrastructures that make it very hard for them to keep employees. And I feel like we need to look at, we have to go back to the corporate structure. We need to see why companies are investing, and we need to build a much more secure set of automatic stabilizers that will protect us from the next recession when it comes.
Mike Gunzel, stand by. Mark Blythe, please, we're going to hear your remedy for your way to full employment too. Coming up, the Renaissance Range and the real fruits of John Maynard Keynes's thinking with his biographer, Robert Skidelsky. This is Open Source. Here is the sound of the economist John Maynard Keynes. In the dark hour of 1939, he's on the BBC telling England that a huge investment in arms would pay a dividend when the war ended.
It is not an exaggeration to say that the end of abnormal unemployment is in sight. The grand experiment has begun. If it works, if expenditure on armaments really does cure unemployment, I predict that we shall never go back all the way to the old state of affairs. Good may come out of evil. We may learn a trick or two which will come in useful when the day of peace comes.
Lord Robert Skidelsky wrote a biographical masterpiece in three volumes about Lord Keynes as one of the giant 20th century modernist minds at the Freud, Joyce, Nabokov level. Keynes's nonfiction theme just happened to be money. 5 years after he finished writing The Life, the financial collapse of 2008 prompted a fourth volume and a strong, readable case for the Keynes comeback. Lord Skidelsky spoke with me this week.
It was a golden age. And I think it was the best period in Western societies and indeed the whole world for all classes of the population. It was also a very, very stable period. There weren't any major recessions. And for the working classes, they'd never had such job security, growth of incomes for such a period of time in the whole of modern history.
Take us into the study with him, maybe with a glass of sherry or whatever. Who was this man?
Well, he was part of England's intellectual elite. He went to England's top school, Eton. He then went to Cambridge, where he got a very, very good degree in mathematics, actually. So he really moved in the top circles all through his life, but he had a strong social conscience, which was inherited from his parents. And he thought also that allowing a lot of unemployment to happen was a terrific waste of resources and a waste of welfare, which could be provided. So both on moral grounds and on intellectual grounds, he was appalled by what happened in the interwar years and governments allowing a Great Depression to happen.
There's a model of a man there and of a method so unlike the picture of economics today. I mean, it's huge mathematical models, big data, but there's something missing in that human touch.
Yes, I think economists were much more broadly educated in Keynes's time than they are now. Now they're very narrow specialists. Keynes said to be a good economist, you have to not only be a mathematician, but you have to be something of a historian, you have to be something of a philosopher, and you have to know about the human condition. That's what training of economists today deprive the students of.
I guess the question is, how would the mind of John Maynard Keynes redirect our attention today?
Well, I think he would redirect our attention from the view that governments are the problem rather than the solution. That was Reagan's famous remark.
Right.
Governments are the problem, not the solution. And a lot of orthodox economics has been devoted to trying to get governments out of the economic system, repealing regulation that hampered the flow of capital, for example, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, and really repudiating fiscal policy as a way of balancing economies. So there was this exaggerated faith in the self-regulating market and deep suspicion of government, the two going together. And then, of course, you had the shock of 2008, which not only was unexpected, but the economics in office, if one can put it that way, gave one no ground for believing that anything like that could happen. And that's what's caused a big rethink.
How would he address robots? You know, we talk about a jobless recovery, but a jobless world almost. What would he say about putting people to human work?
He did say something about it, curiously enough, in the depth of the Great Depression. He wrote a very interesting short essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. And he said that with increasing automation, there'd be what he called a growth of technological unemployment. Not unemployment due to demand deficiency, but due to just machines taking the place of human labor. And he said, the way we have to deal with that is to increase the possibilities of leisure and actually educate people for leisure, give people an income that wasn't based on work, but enlarged the choices that they could make between working and leisure. So what he thought would happen would be that hours of work would gradually decrease, and that the period when people could choose what to do and do unpaid work or work that they wanted to do would gradually increase. And what he didn't foresee was that we'd still be working by necessity 40 or 35-hour week. So he would have wondered why that had happened.
Maybe the biggest charm of Lloyd Keynes today is that he talked about economics basically without numbers. He said he was not prepared to sacrifice human realism to mathematics. He said the goal of good economics was that people live wisely, agreeably, and well. And he said very close to his death that his big regret was that he hadn't drunk more champagne.
He was very, very much aware of the good things of life. He was also a member of the Bloomsbury Group, which was a group of painters and writers, and certainly people devoted to what we call the higher pleasures. Keynes himself loved literature, he loved music, and he wrote, as you say, extremely well. And his style of writing was influenced by very good writing examples of his friends, one of whom was Lytton Strachey, the first modern biographer. So Keynes was an all-round person, and his widow, or his wife, said about him that he was more than an economist. He didn't think that economics could be reduced to maths. He didn't think that a mathematical proof was the same as establishing any situation in the real world. And he also believed in communication. And you communicate through eloquence, certainly through the power of argument, but certainly through eloquence.
Robert Skidelsky's book from 2009, titled Keynes, The Return of the Master, is history for non-economists, and I gotta say, it's irresistible reading. Mark Blythe, you're more than an economist, but where are the rest of them that we can read and smile with and imagine our enlarged choices at our leisure?
Well, in a sense, we risk sort of giving economics too much of a central place in this conversation. So I'll tell you something that I hear all the time when I talk to people who work in financial markets, because that's where the money is and that's where the power is. And one of them, who's very senior, said to me in passing, he said, you know why we have economists at this firm? I said, no. And he says, because they're the people we put on TV. So they go out and give PR for the film. We tell them what to say. We wouldn't let them near an investment portfolio of our lives depended on it. So, you know, we risk giving economics too much credit in this one. And think of Europe, right? Yes, there are bad economic ideas. Yes, they follow the policy of austerity. Yes, they've done tremendous damage. But a lot of it has to do with the structure of the EU. A lot of it has to do with the incentives facing politicians. And they use economics as a crutch as much as it is a weapon, as much as it is a guiding or a blinding light.
Hmm. Mike, I'm also looking for the pro-stylists. I mean, John Kenneth Galbraith was a marvelous writer, whether you liked his economics or not. Paul Krugman writes well. Jeff Sachs writes well. Amartya Sen, I guess, writes well. Yanis Varoufakis talks incredibly well. But we need more for the general citizen, don't we?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's tough because, as Mark said, you don't want to overplay the role of economics in a lot of this stuff. A lot of it has to do with political considerations. A lot has to do with opportunism. You know, in the United States, I think, you know, if the Republicans were in charge, they'd have a very different tone, the way they had a different tone early in the W. Bush years when they were all about, you know, cutting checks and building things and trying to bring about full employment. You know, I think what we really need is a sustained social movement and a social base, because I think that's what allows intellectuals and content, you know, ideas producers to really amplify what they're doing and vice versa. And I think we're starting to see, you know, the edges of it. I think the Fight for 15 movement, I think, you know, a lot of public sector unions have become much more aggressive. You know, I think you're starting to see Black Lives Matter is really talking a lot about economic issues and segregation and how that plays out in their lives. I think you're starting to see a new radicalism. And I think, you know, the interplay between that and economic ideas will be much more interesting than getting another economist in the room who might have slightly better ideas.
I got to put in a plug for another writer, and Lloyd Sadelsky loves him, Nicholas Nassim Taleb, the Black Swan dude who has unraveled it's a sort of economic phenomenon, these unpredictable but inevitable disasters that change everything. Speaking of writers, though, this question, WWKD, what would Keynes do? We've been asking it to all sorts of people. One of them this week was the economist Danny Roderick at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he focused sharply on people.
I think Keynes would say, you know, what a waste of human resources that we have. More than 20% of people unemployed in Spain, half of the youth in Greece are unemployed. What a waste of talent and ingenuity, and what a waste of human resources. And he would say, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. These are not outcomes that are imposed on us from the sky. They don't just fall on our laps. These are consequences of our own decisions, and we can reverse these. And of course, he had some very specific fiscal tools that he imagined could help the situation, and I think those tools are still very relevant today. You know, the paradox is that we actually don't need another Keynes. We're not short of ideas about how to fix what we have. The ideas of Keynes are still relevant. Now we express them in much fancier math, and we have much more sophisticated models, and the basic idea is still there. All the problems that we have in terms of trade and its consequences for inequality, its consequences for loss of control, all of these things are in our economics models as well. So I don't think the problem is that we lack ideas or that economists don't have the models either to explain what has been happening or models that provide a way forward. I think it's much more the lack of political imagination, that in particular, the political left has not been able to package these ideas in a creative and politically appealing way, and therefore made itself much more electable. Instead, I think for the most part, until very recently, they've attached themselves to the hyper-globalization bandwagon. You know, the European socialists were the most ardent supporters of capital account mobility and financial integration and free flow of finance. You know, the Clinton Democrats in the United States were, you know, the big push behind NAFTA and more trade agreements. You know, I don't want to condemn across the board things like NAFTA, but I think we've done too much in terms of moving in the direction of hyper-globalization, too little in terms of doing enough that would legitimize an open global economy.
That was Danny Roderick at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Mark Blythe, we're appointing you Treasury Secretary, no matter who.
That's a really bad idea, Chris.
Well, we're doing it because you think and talk very persuasively. Your assignment will be to put the full employment back on the agenda. How?
All right, here's the pitch. What's an economy? An economy is nothing more, and it really is nothing more, than the number of people times the number of hours worked plus the capital and technology they've got to hand. And that's why what Danny started off with is the most powerful thing of all. Keynes was concerned with full employment not just because it's fair, not just because it's nice that people have jobs. That's the outcome of the economy. And if you waste that talent, if you forget that input, if you, to go back to robots, swap those people for robots without actually having any compensation, then not only is the economy not serving the people, you're basically destroying the economy from the inside out, because that's all it is. So if you don't have full employment at the best possible wages of the target, you're kind of undermining the point of the entire game.
Mike Consul, do you want to review the Treasury Secretary, the program?
You put me in as Federal Reserve Chair while you're at it. And,
and we have no money for that, do we, Mike?
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, one thing I think Keynes would be really interested in, given right now, is what a lot of people call short-termism. Hillary Clinton described it as quarterly capitalism. But the really intense way financial markets put pressure on firms to not engage in long-term investments, either in their workers or in, you know, in infrastructure or innovation or research, but instead is really focused on short-term dividends and short-term buybacks. You know, in Keynes's vision, and he wrote about it in several of his essays, he kind of figured in the long run, in addition to the increased scope for leisure that robotics and other things would bring about, he also imagined a kind of socialization of the firm, is what he called it. But the idea that firms would be much more publicly minded, publicly spirited, almost like universities, I think is an example he used. And we have gone in the exact opposite direction, where universities are now run like hard for-profit businesses. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic that would have also been very different than what he imagined, in addition to the relentless austerity and mass unemployment and less leisure. The way business and the way that firms are even more focused on profits, to the large exclusion of productive investment, huge innovations, it's all about appeasing the shareholders now. I think that's a really interesting dynamic that he would want to think about and figure out ways you could push back against.
Mark Blythe.
I won't trump it. I'll just compliment it in both senses of the word. Well, another thing that Keynes is concerned with is taxation. And if you go back to 1965, not only did they have much higher marginal tax rates when you had a much more equal income distribution, corporates paid about 20% of tax. You know what they pay now? About 2% of total tax. What does Apple pay? Well, according to the European Commission, it's 0.002%. Now, let's just put
Ireland.
Put to one side that's a scandal, etc. Where's the rest of the taxes coming from? Well, it's coming from people who have already had stagnant wages. It's certainly not coming from the top. So there's a gap. And if the gap can't be filled in, what do you get? You get deficits and austerity. So one of the things you need to bring here is a balance. And that balance also involves you get all the benefits of this high employment growth economy. That's what generates your profits. Pay your taxes. And what we've done for the past 30 years is give corporates an absolute blank check to write themselves a blank check, including share buybacks and all the nonsense they get up to boost their internal profitability and skew the income distribution ever further. That would be a strong Keynesian policy, and it's nothing to do with government spending. It's about government collecting.
Mike, is that on your short list?
Yeah, I think Keynes got it mostly right. And I think, you know, that's definitely a much more, you know, you look one for one where high marginal tax rates fell in the 1970s is exactly where the 1% went skyrocketing. And you can look at it one country by country. You know, Piketty and Sayas have done really excellent graphs on this and research on this. And the high marginal taxation doesn't just raise revenue. It also kind of prevents turning CEOs into people who just want to ransack their firms and take as much money out of the top as they want.
Mike Consul, it's wonderful to hear you on Open Source. Mark Blythe, always a pleasure. Thanks also to Danny Roderick, Robert Skidelsky, and Sarah Jaffe. Our show this week was produced by Mary McGrath, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Pat Tomato, George Hicks. And for the last time, it kills me to say this, the boy genius, the beloved Max Larkin. Thank you, Max. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.